Welcome to the Mornings with Sue and Andy podcast for Tuesday, April 23rd. The war between Israel and terrorist group Hamas has dominated headlines for over 6 months. But with Iran now taking aim at Israel, is there a threat that this conflict could spread into neighboring regions? We get the latest on the conflict, including the potential for the use of nuclear weapons, with Mercedes Stevenson, Global News Ottawa Bureau Chief and host of The West Block. Next, the price of post-secondary education is going up year after year. According to Stats Canada, the average yearly cost for Canadian undergraduates has increased to just over $7,000, up 3% from the 2022-2023 academic year. Are you prepared to help your kids navigate the cost of post-secondary education, and are you willing to take on debt to do it? We tackle the topic with Andrew Lowe, CEO and President of Embark Canada. And finally, the Coachella Music Festival wrapped up its second weekend with attendance hitting around 300,000 people over the last 2 weekends. The highest attendance the festival has ever seen, according to sources. But is this an outlier? Has enthusiasm for music festivals started to die away? We get the thoughts of Alan Cross, host of The Ongoing History of New Music on the Chorus Radio Network.
First, it was Russia and Ukraine, then Israel and Hamas. Now, with Iran taking aim at Israel, it feels like a very delicate situation. Should we expect to continue to see escalations? And is there a real concern nuclear weapons could be used? Joining us to discuss is Mercedes Stevenson, Global News Ottawa Bureau Chief and host of The West Block. Good morning to you, Mercedes, and welcome back to the program.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. Now, on the program, on the West Block, you had the chance to speak with Jonathan Panikoff, a former National Intelligence Officer. Does he believe there's a risk of a greater escalation between Iran and Israel?
So basically what Jonathan told me is that he believes neither country actually wants to go to war with the other. And that's part of why you've seen, while these have been shocking and stunning direct strikes on each other, which we don't often see from Israel and Iran, there's sort of lots of subterfuge and veiled or cloaked attacks. This has been out in the open. He thinks neither one of them want to escalate that. And part of what we saw with that was the Iranians last week saying that the strike by Israel was a child's drone. It was a toy. It wasn't serious. Of course, it wasn't any of those things. It was very much a real drone with real capabilities. But the Iranians decided to kind of call it rather than say, we're going to strike back, which is what they initially had threatened, what they said would be a devastating and decisive strike if Israel were to hit them again. Part of this has to do with the targeting. Both Israel and Iran largely have been selective in either what they're using. In the case of the Iranians, drones and missiles, which Israel and the United States were capable of shooting down. And in the Israelis' case, they were very careful not to strike civilian populations in Iran or nuclear facilities, because either of those on either side could trigger an all-out war. But basically, Jonathan Panikoff says it's not in either of their interests. Iran knows that it does not have a military to match Israel's. Also, the regime is deeply unpopular with the people of Iran, and any weakness there could see them overthrown. And for the Israelis, they're trying to deal with Gaza still. So The idea of having a war open on a second front is not something that appeals to them either.
Mercedes, when I brought you in, I used the term delicate, quote-unquote, a very delicate situation. Part and parcel of that is the nuclear threat Iran poses. Does that enter into the equation? What would be the possibility of Iran using nukes?
So at this point, they don't have the nuclear weapons, but they're close to having a crude one. Speaking to both Jonathan Panikoff and previously David Petraeus, who's the former head of the CIA, both have told me that they believe that the Iranians are about 10 to 13 days out from having enriched enough uranium to make one crude nuclear weapon. But that's one crude one versus the Israelis, what is believed to be fairly extensive and sophisticated nuclear program. So there's a much larger deterrent from Israel and their ability to strike with nuclear capabilities than Iran. But one of the big question marks for both the U.S. and Israel is, will they allow Iran to become nuclear? Or if Iran continues to push, I mean, they've been at this 10 to 13 day threshold for quite some time. They're not accelerating that program, according to what I'm being told by these experts. I obviously don't have the intelligence as much as I wish I did. But if they were to accelerate that, there might be a possibility of a strike to prevent them from becoming nuclear. So ironically, the deterrent is sort of in Iran right now, sitting on that nuclear threshold versus trying to move past it to where they could use one.
I'm wondering, Mercedes, with the entrance of Iran into this conflict, does this change the stance of some of the countries supporting Israel, or maybe does it fortify their support? How does that play into the whole change with Iran entering?
It does, because the U.S. has basically given what they call a security guarantee to Israel. They will defend them. And we saw that when the Iranians launched those hundreds of drones and missiles. It was American-backed systems that shot a number of them down, not just Israeli. And this happened right around the time when Joe Biden was starting to more actively criticize Benjamin Netanyahu and the Israeli war cabinet for how they were conducting the war in Gaza. Now, they may criticize them for that, but they will not abandon them to Iranian attacks. At that time, of course, we saw the Israelis choose to strike the Iranian consulate in Syria. And there's a big debate inside Israel right now about whether that was a strategic error or whether it was a political calculation to do something that would trigger Iran and therefore cause the international community to shore up their support for Israel again, or if this was simply a desire to kill somebody who was a high-profile target from the Iranian regime and it was only a military calculation. But I was speaking with some Israeli sources yesterday and in days prior to that, and of course we saw the head of Israeli military intelligence resigned yesterday. That is mostly because of what happened on October 7th, but also there's been a lot of questions about some of the decisions that have been made by that individual since, including the decision on the Syria strike. So it's not really clear how and why that happened, but there is certainty that it caused the U.S. to vocally say that they were supporting Israel more, as of course they would, because an attack from Iran and that widening regional conflict is a very, very serious risk.
I want to, just before we let you go, because we're a week into it, the dust has settled somewhat, or has it really? The quote from Prime Minister Justin Trudeau following the release of the 2024 budget was, "This budget is about fairness for every generation." We've had a week to look at it. What are you finding from reaction from the opposition, and where we go from here with the new budget, Mercedes?
I mean, no huge surprises in terms of spending. The biggest surprise, perhaps, was the one we started hearing about the day before, and that was the increase to the capital gains tax. That has a lot of people concerned who, for example, own secondary properties that they don't live in. It's basically gone up from about 50% to about two-thirds for any property or any capital gains you have over $250,000 when you sell it. The Conservatives, of course, are not supporting it. That's no surprise. But they also won't say whether they would reverse the capital gains tax if they were to come into power. The NDP says they haven't made their minds up yet, but I would be shocked if they don't support this, because PharmaCare and a number of other contingencies that they had agreed to support the government for are going forward, at least on a limited basis. But an interesting thing to keep your eye on for Jagmeet Singh, he's starting to change his tune on the carbon tax. And that is certainly not something that the Liberals anticipated. So I'm very interested to see where that goes.
And we'll have our eye on it, as you will as well. Thanks for your time, Mercedes.
Thanks for having me.
Mercedes Stevenson, Global News Ottawa Bureau Chief and host of The West Block. The price of post-secondary education is going up year after year. According to Stats Canada, the average yearly cost for Canadian undergraduates has increased to $7,076, up 2.9% from the 2022-2023 academic year. Now, are you prepared as a parent to help your kids navigate the cost of a post-secondary education? And are you willing to take debt on to do it, or even, you know, push your retirement back? Joining us to discuss a new study on the issue from Embark, Canada's resource for education savings and planning, is Embark CEO and President Andrew Lowe. Good morning to you.
Hey, good morning. Thank you for having me on the show.
Thank you for joining us, Andrew. We appreciate it. What's your greatest takeaway from the survey, Andrew?
Yeah, so we surveyed 1,000 parents across Canada, and we discovered that the majority think that a post-secondary education is essential for their kids' success. And 82%, a majority of parents feel that it is their responsibility to help their child pursue a post-secondary education. However, there is the topic of inflation, as you mentioned. increasing expenses from gas to interest rates to groceries have put immense pressure on parents, and they've pushed savings for post-secondary education down the priority list. In fact, 87% noted that the increasing expenses have made it really hard to save. And it indexed, if I just carve out Albertans, 92% of Albertans felt that increasing expenses made it hard to save in general. And the majority of parents really believe that supporting their child is more important than their own financial health. And the majority wants to take on debt themselves than to have their child take debt after secondary education. They all realize, you know, having a debt-free degree or diploma come out of school will put them on a better path. You know, the ability to take more risk, be more entrepreneurial, to pursue their ideal kind of career and lifestyle and so on. And without the worry of debt, will put them much further ahead.
Andrew, I'm wondering, you know, as a parent, I have four kids, and I'm assuming all four will go to some sort of post-secondary institution. In fact, you know, my oldest daughter is in university as we speak. But it used to be, Andrew, way back when, not exactly set it and forget it, but your RESP would be there for you. You'd set up your RESP, maybe get some kind of a benefit from the government to contribute to said RESP, and you would pay your monthly, you know, whatever amount you thought would be the best to get your student and your child where they wanted to go. Are the RESPs not working the way they used to, or was it a hit from the past few years when it comes to the pandemic? Why aren't the RESPs the go-to, and why aren't they enough?
Yeah, we think, you know, our job is to get awareness for the RESPs and how to save using that mechanism. So when you save, the government will contribute up to 20% on top of your contribution $500 a year. So basically money, if you think about it over time and over the compound interest and compound investment earnings that you can get. So we think that more awareness is really required, because clearly on our website, embark.ca, you can, you know, if your child just born 18 years from now, mm-hmm. a four-year degree is going to cost about $40,000. Wow. So working backwards, how do you get there? And so if we have 18 years to build our savings and to get the government grants, it turns out that if we each parent save about $50 a month in an RESP and allow that to grow and get all the government grants, they will in 18 years get that $40,000. Yes. So it is possible. We heard, you know, all parents open an RESP. I know it's tough this time to start saving. You know, maybe $50 per parent is a lot of money. And so start small. Start with $5 or $10. But just get into the habit of saving. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, as your career grows, as your, you know, personal wealth grows, you may in the future be able to afford to contribute more to an RESP. But now that the account is set up and you have an automatic, you know, mental muscle to put money in there, no matter how little it is, you'll be surprised how much you will have at the end of 18 years when your kids are ready to go to school. You know, another example of this is take a look at your RRSP or TFSA. So if you're saving in those mechanisms now, I bet you at what your account balances look like, you may be surprised on how much is actually in there after only saving a very small amount.
It's nice to hear that there is some hope, Andrew, and I guess part of it is making sure you touch base with a professional like yourself. Thank you so much for your time, Andrew. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
You too. That's Andrew Lowe, President and CEO of Embark, E-M-B-A-R-K. And you can find out more about what he does at embark.ca. The Coachella Music Festival wrapped up its second weekend with attendance hitting around 300,000 people over the two weekends, the highest attendance the festival has ever seen. That's according to sources. But is this an outlier? Has enthusiasm for music festivals started to die away? Joining us to discuss is Alan Cross, host of the ongoing history of new music right here on the Chorus Radio Network. And good morning to you and welcome back to the program, Alan.
Well, thanks very much.
Well, you know, you see these images on social media. You see pictures of these very popular music festivals. Are you telling us that, you know, our interest is waning in them? Because it looks like they're jam-packed.
Well, it does look a bit maybe deceiving in the photographs, but the truth about Coachella is that it took a very, 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 very long time to sell out. Usually Coachella would sell out instantly, even before a lot of the acts have been announced. It did not happen this year. And even as late as this past Thursday, the Thursday before the second weekend of Coachella, there were still tickets available. Mm. And that would have never, ever, ever happened in the past. And if you branch out from just Coachella, which is probably the biggest music festival in all of North America, you start to see that there's a lack of enthusiasm on the festival circuit this year. Lollapalooza in Chicago in May, there's not a lot of buzz about it. Bonnaroo doesn't feel very exciting. Oceaga and Festival d'Été in Quebec are okay, but nobody's really terribly excited about it. In fact, there have even been moans about Glastonbury, the most famous music festival in the world. And this is a festival that sells out in minutes, months before anybody knows who will be performing. And the complaints about Glastonbury this year are, these are the best headliners you could get. It'll still be, you know, it's still sold out. People will still do the whole thing in the mud and the booze and the drugs and all the rest of it. But it's the year of meh when it comes to festivals.
Interesting. Well, it's an interesting note, Alan, because our producer, Mornings with Sue and Andy producer, Reece Schaefer, huge music fan, and he was letting us know that he used to go to the Sasquatch Music Festival every year down at the Gorge in Washington State, I believe. It canceled back in 2018. So there's one that, you know, just kind of fell apart. Are you seeing that? Are you seeing some festivals, you know, kind of dismantling, or some festivals, you know, closing their doors?
Yeah, well, there's a reason there's not a lot of big festivals in Canada is because it's just too expensive. And with the exchange rate and all the logistics that are involved, it just makes it extremely, extremely difficult to stage a major festival in this country. The other thing that happened was COVID. A lot of festivals haven't bounced back from that. A bunch of festivals were canceled in Australia, and there were all kinds of festivals canceled in England and the UK because they just couldn't maintain, it just didn't make financial sense. And I think there's a lot of reasons for this. If we look at just the financials of it all, doesn't matter which country you're talking about. Last year, a lot of people spent a lot of money on Taylor Swift and Beyonce. Is there any money left to spend on other things this year? That is a real cost, that's a real concern. It's the end of funflation. Remember how after COVID receded, we said, screw it, we're going to go out and spend money on travel and trips and things that make us feel good. Well, we're kind of running out of money for that, largely because of interest rates and inflation. Gen Z, they're not, it's turning out that they may not be the festival goers that we saw with boomers and Gen X and millennials. They have been called Generation Sensible, and they don't party as much as their predecessors. I'm speaking generally. They don't party as much. And I saw a study that says that even those Gen Zs who go to a festival, 5%, just 5% say that they're excited about doing drugs and drinking. Just 5%.
So it's an age thing, and I get that in the sense that the Lilith Fairs and some of these other big festivals that came up, they were us. They were generations even older than us, and now the importance might not be there. So I guess we might see a reimagining. Could it be that we see a rebirth and a different type of festival as we move ahead, Alan?
Well, maybe, but at the same time, the big festivals have lots of momentum. There's lots of money invested in them. This could be cyclical. People will just, you know, once we get back into the idea of going to festivals, they may come back. Now, the biggest problem, I think, with all the festivals is a music one, because the music industry has done a terrible job of creating new superstars over the last 25 years. And the ones that do exist, and I'm thinking of Taylor Swift and Beyonce, they don't want to be at festivals. They can make far more money and have far more control by launching their own headlining tours. A festival is an annoyance to them. The older acts, and I'm talking about from the 1990s and earlier, you know, we got Madonna, Green Day, Blink-182, Springsteen, Metallica, Tool, Pearl Jam. They know this too, and they would rather go out on the road by themselves than have to deal with a festival for which they would have to scale down their show. And then you have the super heritage acts, Rolling Stones, Paul McCartney, the Eagles. These people are in their 70s and 80s. Do you think they want to spend time at a festival? No. Now, there are other older acts to choose from, but A, they're not going to get boomers out of their houses because boomers don't want to stand in a field for a weekend anymore. It's the same with a lot of Gen Xers. The older acts are not appealing to young festival fans, which is the festival's bread and butter. And the other acts are dying off.
Wow.
So what we're left with is, it pains me to say this, but a B-list of headliners.
Wow.
I mean, you know, Lana Del Rey at Coachella, I mean, she's good. But, you know, this is a slot, you know, once headlined by Guns N' Roses and AC/DC and Radiohead and Eminem. And it's just not the same.
Very interesting times, Alan. We appreciate your insight and always love a chance to talk music with you. Thanks for your time.
Thanks, Alan.
Alan Cross, host of the ongoing History of New Music, heard right here on the Chorus Radio Network.